Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth.
It is just in the in-between Christmas and New Year period, reflecting on our lives, and it's my great pleasure to invite one of my favourite founders from the Techstars program that I did last year. Actually, well, I love all of the founders before I just dig some holes for myself, but you were a solo founder and
awesome
company. You still are, which is a topic I think we could discuss at some point also on the podcast. But anyway, Roland Decourt, founder of Decourt Future Industries, building the future of healthcare, here on the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here, Sam. And Mutual, you were obviously one of my favorite founders.
Thank you very much. Good. Well, before this stays too awkward, I would like to basically have a bit of an introduction on you in terms of what did you study, where did you come from, why are you building a company? Can you just give me the lowdown, please, so everyone else knows rather than just me?
Yeah, so I'm Roland. I'm CEO and founder of Decourt Future Industries. So we build technology that, for the first time, collects the data that all our bodies are constantly emitting. So that's data that can save and alter lives, but generally and rather bafflingly gets ignored by almost all of us on a daily basis. We use artificial intelligence that allows us to continuously analyze your biometric status just through sound, everything from heart rate to respiratory rate to gastrointestinal, all simply by listening to your body. And building on this new acoustic method, we've created a cost-effective way of continuous health analysis, so one that enables predictive and preventative rather than just curative medicine. So essentially trying to prevent something from happening rather than just focusing on fixing things when they go wrong. We do this using long-term patterns and real-time data that we provide to carers, healthcare providers, and individuals. And that our hope is, and actually this is something we're already seeing, can significantly impact both quality of life as well as longevity, which is, I think, something we can talk about further down the line. But yeah, so mainly the thing that kind of sets us apart is that due to the low cost of the hardware, so all we really need is a microphone, acoustic biometric gathering is an extremely kind of cost-effective new method. It's inspired by PhD research by our team at the University of Cambridge, and it allows us to build the largest database of constantly streaming human health data because all we need is just a microphone. So yes, that's kind of the lowdown on who we are. Now, I think what you were asking more is the why and what we're doing, Is that more specific?
Yeah, the why, and also the pre-life up to now, like...
Yeah, so I grew up in a pretty political family. So my parents kind of met each other at a political event, and everyone in my family's always been very political. We used to have these long conversations at the dinner table. And as a result, as a young, naive kind of student and a kid, I wanted to become a politician. So I always thought that the best way to make an impact on the world was through politics. So you asked, what did I do at university? I'm rather an unconventional tech entrepreneur, that my background is in the humanities, specifically in something called ancient code breaking, where we break codes or we work on codes that are about 5,000 years old, from about 3,000 BC to about 1450 BC. And we use modern cryptographic methods as well as linguistic methods to try and break and crack those codes. I got to that through kind of the study of Latin and Greek, which is something I already did at school. But yes, it doesn't seem directly connected to AI, but it actually is in many kind of relevant ways. And I could talk about that a bit more later.
But I mean, I do love a tangent as it is. I would just like to understand, because I still don't quite understand exactly what ancient code breaking means. And I'm sure if I don't, then no one else does right now. Is this like the symbols that happen to be on some rock somewhere? And they're like, well, there was a message from these people in this one sort of tribe to another? Or is this like trying to work out whole languages?
Well, both, right? In order to understand and scripts more so than even language, because obviously language and script are separate. Like you say, that some people would carve on some rock somewhere, say, for example, seal stones, right? Which have individual images on them that you then use to impress on some wax or clay, and then you use that for whatever administrative purpose. And in order to understand that, you will need to understand the overall structure of the script, which in itself is governed by the structure of the language. So you start with something like a database of hundreds and hundreds of individual seal stones, all of them with individual images on them. And then you extract those individual images, look for patterns, start seeing whether or not you can see certain repetitions, certain meaningful patterns that might indicate the structure of the script. And then the structure of the script can allow you to figure out what the structure of the language might be. Say, for example, if you think about one of the codes that was broken at the university in the office that I was working in, but almost a century ago now, is linear B. Well, not quite a century, half a century. And linear B was broken, so by Fentress and Chadwick at, well, Chadwick at Cambridge, Fentress was actually an architect who did it in his spare time. And one of the things that we know with linear B is that it was adapted from a script originally created for another language. Because when I say sometimes from the script, you can find out things about the language, all the endings that, for example, in Greek, because linear B encoded Greek, that occur are very hard to put in linear B into the script. So the natural endings had to be kind of simulated by doubling certain letters and certain signs, which meant that, well, doubling is the wrong word. Say, for example, os or anything like that, they wouldn't have necessarily a sign for that specific ending. So you'd have to create different signs or use kind of clever ways in which to try and recreate the natural patterns of that language, indicating that the script wasn't made for that language. But that's still quite a tangent. What I essentially wanted to say is that, indeed, being a political child, kind of one of the things that I did a lot was also, because Latin and Greek is what brought me into code breaking, one of the things I did a lot was essentially kind of build up from the beginnings of like earliest political thought and then going to university to pursue that.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like first principles, but for politics as opposed to science.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Nice. Could you say that code breaking is a bit like a very, very complex form of Sudoku where you have like a few signs, as long as you can like make sure that they're always the right ones, you can then kind of slowly work out where everything else is as a sort of pattern, but 100 times more complex, and that would be a very bad way of saying it.
No, but I think most of these things, I mean, even building a business, right, is pattern recognition. Yeah. So I would say if you break things, a lot of these kind of processes down at the core of them all is pattern recognition. One of the things that a lot of people, when they think of code breaking, is essentially there's a message encoded in script as we understand it, like with Sudoku, right, in a language that we expect behind a series of enigmatic symbols. So you can see this a lot when people create kind of codes or when they try and create a new script or whatever, is that they essentially just create a script again for the language they understand, which almost invariably kind of in popular media will be English. The reality, of course, is if you think about the signs that were created by people, say, for example, 5,000 years ago, those signs might represent concepts. They might be ideograms. They might not represent a letter, right? They might not letters also themselves are, you know, especially alphabetic, is something quite late. So you can have like consonant, vowel, or vowel consonants. You can have it break down individual parts of a word, or you can have the whole word represented, or you can have a concept represented, or you can have a concept represented that is depicted partially artistically, partially linguistics. Like, for example, if you have Mayan glyphs, you can have the headdress of a king actually spelling out his name. But unless you know that, unless you are part of that, it's not something that you can necessarily easily recognize as script. So one of the things that, for example, a lot of people did wrong in the ancient code breaking, kind of the field that I was in, specifically for Crete in about 3000 BC to 1450 BC, is what most people looked at, is they looked at these individual symbols and they only considered as writing when there were individual, clearly marked, isolated symbols that sequentially kind of appeared after each other. And that was writing. And all the little dots and squiggles around it were ignored, right? But the reality is that's just writing as we now think, well, we now perceive writing. Writing back when could be literally anything from, you know, scratched on a signpost to a... So I would say the difference with kind of Sudoku is you know what game you're playing. When you do this kind of ancient code breaking, you don't know whether behind this, and again, for example, with the Mesoamerica and with the Mayans versus a lot of neighboring cultures, they could all read each other's signs and understand the signs, but they associated them with different words in their own languages, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So in code breaking, there's so many layers to figure out before you even get to the Sudoku bit. The Sudoku bit is the very last bit, is when you actually already know what the rules are.
Nice. Yeah. Cool. I'm glad I...
you did say you like tangents. Yeah. That's definitely...
I feel like I have a much better idea in my head of what it actually means. Because I remember when you first said it, I was kind of like... My first image was kind of like... code breaking for sort of like Nazi war films and things, and just sort of like
it's interesting things. Like especially early on, because code breaking wasn't necessarily something that was very common. I mean, you have things like Caesar ciphers and whatever, but it wasn't necessarily something, especially computerized code breaking is obviously very, very recent because computers are recent. But similarly, also it was primarily during the world wars that kind of code breaking became a really big thing. And most code break, especially early on, because it encodes language, now we think, okay, code cryptography is the realm of computer science. But again, and this is again where my argument kind of comes in, both pattern recognition and also why I did what I did and how I think it is actually a pretty natural evolution to end up now creating tech and kind of working on machine learning and so forth, is that even for things like computerized cryptography, you know, the beginnings and the earliest stages of it were, okay, it's essentially just codes that are encoding language. So you end up having linguists who've worked with Latin and Greek when you don't have, you know, computerized cryptography yet, when you don't have anyone who is specialized in codes yet. What comes closest was essentially linguists who had been working with ancient languages. So for the effort in the war at Bletchley Park, for example, a lot of the people working there were linguists who had previously worked with ancient languages, because they were used to these kind of this type of pattern recognition for code breaking. So yeah, I think something that not a lot of people kind of realize.
But that, definitely. Well, good. Now we know. So, background from pattern recognition. I mean, we could also go on the fact that you were pretty young when you went to university, if I remember correctly. That was a thing.
Yeah, so I first went to Cambridge for like just attending a couple of lectures and talked to people at 15, then got the scholarship at 16, and then started living
there. How do you get to Cambridge as a 15-year-old?
I hadn't matriculated at that stage, right? Essentially, at that stage, it was just, I was a difficult child in school, and that then kind of led to some analysis. Then some people said, okay, you should skip a couple of years and then potentially go to England for university, because the focus is slightly more on essay writing and slightly less on rehashing.
You do write a good essay.
And
prolific.
And the thing then was that we were simply looking for a environment where the focus is indeed on allowing the person to say counter-argue even the point, which is actually one of the first essays I ever wrote at Cambridge, was for a professor who I have immense respect for, who I still consider my academic father, who actually his partner is my academic mother, so it happens, because she's the one who admitted me. Essentially, my first essay for him was an essay where I challenged his view. So he was this professor with kind of, you know, 25 years, 30 years of experience in the field, that kind of wrote this essay saying this is how XYZ should be interpreted. And I said, I disagree. I think it should be interpreted this that way. And I essentially, that was the perfect kind of setting for me. I mean, then we had a really great argument. And in retrospect, I'm less convinced of my position. But the fact that this was kind of a setting where you could challenge to such an extent existing knowledge and kind of received wisdom was essentially what we went out looking for. But yeah, so to clarify, I only matriculated to Cambridge, so I became a student and kind of stayed there full time just about a month after my 17th. But yeah,
still pretty early. I was 20 when I got to university, but I just had a gap year, so
yeah,
you know.
But it was, yeah, the main difference, the only difference really, is that they had to create some new software so that my student ID card couldn't be used to buy beers at the college bar.
Yeah,
but then you just got it from a friend. So, but yes, I went there at the time because I did Latin and Greek at school. There's this really strange system in most of like France and a lot of continental Europe that had, well, France only had it up to the revolution, of course, but you know, that had a Catholic background, is that Latin and Greek are seen as the kind of two subjects that you do if you are in the top of your grade, if you're top of your year, and then kind of below that would be sort of other languages, and then below that would be the sciences, which is really strange, like completely contrary to a lot of other countries. But if you do really, really well, you end up not doing physics or anything, you end up doing Latin and Greek.
What?
I know, which was rather...
I mean, physics seems like a really important one.
It really does. Yeah. Really, I think, and they have you do like 15 subjects. So I have 12 A-level equivalents. And it's one of those things where...
What?
I know.
What?
It's
12 A-levels. That's like normal people get like three, right?
Yeah, but that's just, it's more a quirk of the system than it is anything else. It's more a quirk that kind of, they are...
What age were you when you did these A-levels?
It's all kind of set in, essentially, you can't specialize. That's in Belgium, in secondary education. You just can't. You specialize roughly and you choose what they call the direction or like a course. But then within that, you are still forced to do everything else. What I really knew and what I really enjoyed was reading kind of ancient authors, especially at the time, as I said, I was mainly interested in politics. So I wanted to kind of build up that basic knowledge from the ground up. Not that there wasn't kind of lots of complex politics pre-classical kind of period, but rather that's been most of the writings that started, that we kind of are now reading and that still survive, come from. And then it was about my first year into second year that two things happened. On the one hand, I realized in classics too many things had already been written about, were quite well known. It was hard to find something that was particularly kind of a complete unknown. And as I said, I kind of wanted challenges that were more things where very little about it is known and it seems, you know, unreachable, but we can go through it. And this is what essentially I did with the code breaking, is I tried to find an area of classics that people said, don't do that. There's no way you can move forward there at all. Like, I had to convince and even change PhD supervisors and convince kind of lots of people at the faculty that it was worth working on these ancient codes, specifically also one that I worked on, which was Cretan hieroglyphic, because everyone was convinced that nothing could be done about them because we didn't have enough info to work with. We didn't have enough data to work with in the first place. But it was at the same point in time around kind of my second year of undergraduate that I was quite involved in politics, quite involved in like political societies, and then met like the prime minister and everything like that, and very quickly became disillusioned with politics and started realizing the way in which it is a system that you're not really beholden to your constituents, you're not really beholden to kind of the people, you're beholden to the party political system, where the quirks of the system mean that if you want to do it, kind of impart any meaningful change, it is an extremely long and frustrating process that might not actually, you know, be
I don't know if you watched like the Blair and Brown thing on BBC, the Obama one, where you just watch them like just both sort of people that were kind of great and had like 8-4 years were still really struggling to make any kind of meaningful
change. Exactly. So, and it was at the same time, because that's why I wanted to get in politics in the first place. It was to enact meaningful change, right? Or to like try and have an impact on the world.
Yeah.
And I think not sort of just an impact for the sake of having an impact, but rather because I saw certain things that I thought, okay, as everyone does.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get that motivation from that. But it's more that, one of the things that I then started realizing, I did a lot of, back in around that time, a lot of reading in economic theory. And one of the things that I kind of started believing in is that the best way to have a real impact on people around you, actually affect their lives, and not just kind of through headlines or nominally do it, but actually have a real impact in their daily routines, and a positive impact hopefully, is through the market, is through business, is by creating something that they need and they want, which is kind of essentially what we're doing. And I became obsessed with economic theory, specifically also Austrian school economics, which is, you know, Hayek and colleagues. And I started believing that, you know, a free market within obviously kind of appropriate restrictions was the driving force behind lots of things, but most importantly, kind of human happiness. And hence why I wanted to start a company, essentially. So around that time was why I decided to, okay, I'm not going to go into politics. I'm instead going to be a CEO down the line, you know, and create a company, do something kind of meaningful that way. And that became then my focus for most of my life, even though actually I was offered some funding for the MPhil and then Research Council funding for the PhD, and kind of decided to continue on in that as long as I got the funding and was able to also have a meaningful impact on that field. I then finished the PhD thesis, published large swaths of it, and then said to everyone in the academic world, goodbye, I'm now off to build a business, which came as a bit of a shock to some of them, and also, I suppose, to my family. Even though I had been telling them I was going to do this for years, I don't think anyone really believed that I would actually do it.
It's really funny the way that happens when you kind of like, you know what you're going to do, but it doesn't matter when you tell people, they're still kind of like, oh, no one really believes what comes out your mouth until you go and do stuff. And you're like, guys, I've done everything else I said I was going to go and do. Why
wouldn't I do this?
Why are you so surprised?
Exactly. And actually, I had my PhD, like one of the examiners, say something like that day, because when I kind of explained that I was actually looking to start a business, but in the meantime, kind of was that I'd abandoned my academic discipline of choice, and that it's not, academia can be quite a closed off kind of world that is kind of, I mean, it's a wonderful world in some ways, but can also sometimes be inward looking. And I definitely got a lot of hostility, especially at the time I'd made some breakthroughs that are now kind of in the field widely accepted, or becoming widely accepted. And it seemed to everyone, I think, a silly, insane kind of move for me to change tracks that clearly. But for me, it wasn't changing tracks. For me, it was exactly what I had envisioned, kind of what I set out to do. Not that it didn't then take me a year and a half of me just sitting essentially building a product in my kind of guest bedroom, believing very naively at the time that if I just build a really cool product, people would come to me. And then afterwards, when I realized that isn't the case, going out to people and having to explain why I came with essentially an ancient code breaking degree and I was now at that time building exoskeletons, it definitely led to a lot of challenges along the way, walls that we had to kind of walk through. But yeah,
it's things you learn.
Exactly. It was great fun. In fact, that period of extreme kind of uncertainty, where for about a year I was setting up the business, creating the tech, slowly learning these things, kind of building it all up from scratch. It was some of the years that I think for my family, maybe even my wife and most people, was kind of anxiety inducing, and for myself too. But at the same time, it was also one of the most satisfying things, you know, to just go for your vision, to start building something from scratch, to just sit there. I still have just that little,
I feel like that part's less worrying than like the next part when you then take it to market and you sort of turn it into a real business where like every day is like everything can go wrong. Thinking away is awesome.
I think at every stage you think that the next stage is going to be
one where you like you then make it and then you're like, oh god, it's just more stress.
And you don't. Well, I suppose you do, but at the same time you have all this added responsibility. Like for example, now we are raising our seed round. And it's just one of those things also where you start realizing that there's people depending on you for their livelihood, a large amount, well, large-ish, you know, just we're still a small company. But yeah, and they have, for example, you know, a young kid and another kid on the way, and you're the primary kind of source of income for them at this stage. And, you know, you want your responsibility for them too. It does continuously, I think, with every step. You think if I reach that stage, things will be kind of slightly more smooth sailing. I think that's never true. Yeah. But then also, we wouldn't do this.
But it's what keeps you going.
Exactly.
You'd never get there.
Exactly.
And if you realize just how big it was.
Oh, in that sense.
It's like, oh,
true.
The next 7 years of my life, every year will basically be impossible. You're like, okay. No,
but it's
no,
the challenge we live for, right?
Yeah.
Imagine definitely. If it, like, after the start.
Yeah, things are easy. It'd be so
exactly.
Boring.
It would be so dull. If
cheat codes in games, right? So boring.
Exactly. Well, 100%. I mean, why do we play games like Dark Souls and you know, Demon's Souls? I'm now going through Sekiro, right? I'm just need to find a boss.
Yeah.
So games that essentially punish you very, very harshly for making, you know, even a small mistake and that you just have to do over and over again and that ultimately you succeed. It's essentially the same as with a business. And this is a very false analogy here, but, you know, I don't know whether you are familiar with the Dark Souls games, but what essentially you have a boss, you fight that boss, you learn the moveset after like trying 30, 40 times of dying. You kind of learn exactly when to jump, dodge, you know, attack, whatever. And then ultimately you're so good at it, you get massive satisfaction out of beating that boss. And it just makes it the whole journey worth it so much more. And then you go to the next one, the next challenge. Because if it was just that, and this is exactly what I think kind of building a business is like, is I think the main thing that keeps you going, the main thing that motivates you throughout is that there's this big challenge to solve. And we picked this one big challenge, which is the vision, right? And we want to execute on that. So for me, that is introducing predictive and preventative healthcare and allowing all of us to be continuously kind of safeguarded through technology as to our health. And in order to get there, there's all these, the first challenge was, okay, how do I even get this off the ground? How do I start a business? How do I get people interested in us and kind of starting to support us? And then once you solve that challenge, you know, how do I make the team work well? And then that challenge the product. And then ultimately it becomes kind of this continuous ongoing sequence of challenges that just keeps, I think that very much kind of keeps the flame alive rather than, I think, like you say, if it was very easy and it just all went smoothly from stage one, I think you and I would get bored quite quickly.
Yeah, as in most things that I have been good at, like quickly, I kind of been like, well, I can already do this. Doesn't matter.
Exactly.
I'm going to find something else that I can't do yet.
I'm not going to lie. One of the reasons for me also for leaving academia was that I felt that I'd achieved, like I'd published, I had that breakthrough. I felt that I've kind of, done this.
Yeah, it's going to be more of the same. Really.
It's going to be more of the same from now. I could have essentially just kept on publishing on those ideas that I, at that point, had already published and kind of kept on building my entire career on those breakthroughs, but then it would just be more of the same. And I would be wanting to look for new challenges anyway, and which I would find. I'm not saying you definitely, academia can be hugely challenging, but it wasn't the type of challenge I wanted next. But it is very much so that I think once, if you're very good at something from the start, or let's just say if you succeed immediately, because if the challenge itself wasn't really that much of a challenge, then it takes away both the satisfaction, it becomes less. And very often also, it's then something that will be less meaningful. If it's something that can have a huge impact on the world or individuals or society as a whole, then it will, by definition, come with lots and lots and lots of different challenges. Otherwise, people
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I recently wrote a blog around the fact that you should try and find things that you fail at.
Yeah.
More often, as in, because it's probably going to, whatever you're doing, like, make it better. So, like, let's say if I'm doing a podcast, if every single person I ask to be on my podcast says yes, I'm doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Like, I should
then you're
aim
clearly
for, like,
not
90% of people saying no.
Exactly.
And then I'd have, like, totally legit.
Otherwise,
like,
you're not being ambitious
people
enough.
On my podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because raising funding, like, that's a good round of funding if 90% of people say no to you, and it's recognized to be one of the hardest things you can do.
Yeah.
But it, like, massive upside, you now run a business with funding and you're like a baller. So it's like, okay, why can't you approach lots of things that you do with life with the attitude that you try and fail a
fail,
lot of
I know.
It and,
like, as I said earlier, with the game, right?
Harder. Yeah.
With
Dark
Souls, this is what you get the satisfaction out of. And I think it's also what, like, as we heard, kind of makes it meaningful. And I do think that is something, especially in the fundraising process as well. A lot of investors want to invest in people who are on their second company, very often when their first company has failed. Because the, yeah, it's not, and we said this just before kind of the podcast started, but it sounds a cliche, but it's like the journey there rather than the outcome, even though obviously the outcome is what we're all building for. But journey there also has a huge impact on you as a person, because it makes you so much, all the knowledge that you've gained, all the, you know, if VCs are a Dark Souls boss, you know, you now know the moveset and, you know, you're next.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
It is crazy how much I'm learning.
Yeah.
Back to talking about, like, making mistakes and then learning from human behaviors and things. What's one of your biggest mistakes that maybe I could learn from instead of making that mistake myself?
As we've said before, I feel like entrepreneurship is a constant string of making mistakes. But what makes you reasonably, like, what allows you to go forward, I don't want to say successful necessarily, but what allows you to, like, move forward is by realizing that you've made a mistake, learning from it. That's something that, and, like, just to start out, I thought, okay, when I've started and I'd read, like, entrepreneurship books, and I kind of had after my PhD kind of then jumped into it, and I still made that mistake of thinking, if I just build something really cool, people will come to me, and that, you know, that naivete and I need, to some extent, I needed that naivete to kind of sit for a year and a half and just build and like that first exoskeleton. But then down the line, I didn't realize that people, when I had because I had a PhD in the humanities, but I had built an exoskeleton, I needed to get I essentially put it in front of the CPO, then head of engineering at Raspberry Pi, and kind of said to him, I'm trying to kind of create this. And he looked at it and said, this is really cool. And then he had to be the one who, like, explained it to other people and had to be there to give sort of the engineering, because I had underestimated the extent to which people would not want to hear it from me, even though I built the damn thing, simply because I didn't necessarily have the right background. And then one of the other things that I didn't realize that until quite far in. One of the mistakes I made during Techstars, for example, was that I met all these really, really great people, and I focused so much on what is the next step in the fundraising, for example, that I focused, okay, I want primarily angels. I had a couple of VCs interested, but I didn't really want to interact with them yet, because I didn't feel that, you know, I wanted to build the product first, and I didn't feel that necessarily we were, at that point, institutional capital was what we were looking for. But then I essentially, rather than keeping up those weekly emails and, like, making sure that I was got so focused on achieving what I set out to achieve then, that I didn't realize that actually maintaining those, or I did realize it, but I knew it whilst I was not doing it, but I essentially decided to prioritize building the business over maintaining relationships with, for example, existing people from with everyone.
That's a really hard one as well when you're a solo founder, as in, like, you've got to have people on execution, you've got to have people on, like, nurturing all those relationships and things, and when there's just one of you, it's hard.
And I love just having these chats and these conversations. But I, rather than sort of towards the end, and again, most of the angels that ultimately invested in DFI have been people from Techstars. So we have, and some of the most important mentors that we now have still are people from Techstars. And yes, we had to make, as always, you can't expect to keep in touch with all the 300 or whatever people you meet. But I think in retrospect, especially when it then came to firms, just because there's this rather arcane, a warm intro makes everything, which is to some extent, you know, makes sense. But sometimes also it's just, if you know someone at a firm that was there before, but they've now left, but because you've been keeping up, like occasionally checking in with them. And it's just good to keep people kind of up to date as to what you're doing. I didn't do that enough. And people were telling me to do
definitely.
It. Eamon, so MD of Texas London, was constantly telling me to do that. And I essentially deprioritized it. That was a mistake I made then. One of the mistakes I made early on kind of with the hiring was actually, in retrospect, that wasn't a mistake with hiring. I think hiring was just getting people who are really enthusiastic, passionate, and then it can't go wrong if you see that they're not just kind of someone who's there because they, yeah, but it's someone who's there because they really want to build that product, because they're very enthusiastic about their individual tech and they're enthusiastic about the vision. But rather, I feel one of the things that I found during kind of the daily running of the company is that early on, you want to give so much freedom and you want to say essentially, look, let's just consider ourselves a group of friends. I didn't want to build a hierarchy essentially in the company. And definitely came a moment at one point where I realized that was a mistake. There should have been slightly more clear. And there's something that we then created now about a year ago. We then started creating like a bit more clear structure, because for a business to work well, you need to have responsibilities outlined well. And the more that you become a group of friends, it's finding that balance, right?
Definitely.
When I set out, I think actually, on the other hand, as we said, the entrepreneurial process is a sequence of mistakes. But then in many ways, that makes them not mistakes, doesn't it? Because it just means that you are, because the way in which I also see it is, for the beginning, when we started out, actually, being a group of friends was perfect. It is exactly what kept us going, what kept people happy, what made us all. But then we realized at one point that needed to change. Is that then a mistake? Not really, I suppose. So I'm kind of thinking, yeah.
Depending on the timing of things.
Exactly. I think it's a mistake if you realize it and you don't act on it. And by definition, by the time you act on it, it should have happened some time ago. But at the same time, I feel that it's more what's a learning rather than what's a mistake. So yes, I've been giving bogus answers, I'm afraid. Just been talking about learnings rather than proper mistakes.
Yeah, it's been constantly open to change and improving where you're at. And sort of,
except they're not keeping in touch with people. That was an actual mistake on my end.
Definitely.
Still a learning, but also definitely a mistake.
Yeah, and that's something I've certainly found, is that like all of my founders so far like know me well, like have known me for a while, or like Josh Fuller, it took a year from when I met him to when he invested, talking to him about different things. And like, I need to put myself out there a lot more and have people know what the fuck I'm up to more often.
Yeah,
and they actually kind 100%. Of need to know who Sam Harris is and what he does.
Exactly.
So that invested me, whereas if I just turn up, apparently it doesn't go so well.
No, and I think a learning, because you mentioned it was about a year, a learning more than a mistake, I suppose, but a bit of both. Because, well, it's, as we said to the other, for me, for the fundraising process, was also that it takes a lot longer than you think it will. I honestly thought,
mate,
even now, and I've done the pre-seed, and honestly thought for this 2.7
million, I thought, you're like, I think we've got this in the bag now.
I know. I was convinced, because I had our first offer for the full round, and we were. So I was convinced that this 2.7 mil round, that we were going to close that in 2 months. And then in retrospect now, when I talk to everyone's like, obviously that wasn't going to happen. Obviously you can't, you know, have everything sorted out in the way that you want. And we ultimately ended up turning down the one kind of offer for the full round and essentially decided, no, we want these specific people. But then obviously it takes longer, and then also the paperwork still needs to go. So and we're still in the middle of the round now, and we're still kind of, you know, building it 2 months in. But that is super normal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, nevertheless, as you as a company, and as a founder, you will go in it and you'll think, oh yeah, you know, I'll be able to do this in X amount.
Kind of be naive and sort of think on the upside, because of statistically we're doing the stupidest thing ever in terms of like an investor, right? They invest in 100 companies expecting one of them is going to become like a $1 billion company and do everything, and the rest will just be kind of shit. And like us, we're doing something where like I'm going to be possibly, well, most likely one of the 99 of the 100 that doesn't do very well, and there's the one guy that's doing the right thing, and it's probably not me, but I have to kind of believe that it's me and that I'm doing the right thing. And yeah, it's kind of,
I think
I don't think it's fully correct, those statistics, in terms of like actually
I don't think
like
so 50% no and a lot of them are doing valuable things but aren't necessarily getting what they want to get. I think again, for entrepreneurs, it's, and obviously you will have entrepreneurs who are essentially just in it for different reasons, but for I think the majority of us, it's that like that strength of conviction, right? Is that it's less, and I fully believe, obviously, that kind of the technology that I'm building is technology that, you know, would have that huge impact, and that down the line is something that could be used by everyone. I am also fully aware of the fact that if I believe that, which I do, that the economics also indicate that if it's not us, say, for example, for whatever reason we fail, that some other company might do it. It's essentially more a belief in a direction that humanity is going to take. And that it becomes a gamble, but it doesn't mean that your original vision was incorrect. It becomes a gamble kind of for then VCs to figure out who has the correct vision and who can succeed. And there's an extent to which there's going to be things that can be controlled that allow success, and there's things that can't be controlled. And for them, it essentially, yeah, I think it's more a, let's say 60% of the companies or 70% of the companies they invest in have a solid kind of vision. And then, yeah, things might or might not go wrong. And yeah, I don't think it's a 99% is doing useless things and 1% is doing something useful. Mate. Yeah.
But still, like the success power laws of it is still not in our favor. But hopefully we can defy the statistics. Then what is one of your earliest memories?
The problem with that is that a lot of memories are manufactured, where you've seen the video or you've heard, you've seen the photos, you heard the stories that others have told you, and then you seem to remember. So it's in that sense a tricky question. However, one thing I know that no one else knows, therefore it cannot be manufactured, and it was extremely early, is that at one point as a child, I dreamt of getting Pikachu slippers. And the morning after, my mum had bought me Pikachu slippers. So that is an experience that has stuck with me for a while, which it definitely isn't in, because my normal answer to that would be, there is this story where I saw a cute little flower on top of like a, I think I told this one in Techstars, on top of a cliff in France, at the side of a mountain. And it was this one kind of peak, essentially, that had just a, that was, had just a, enough room, like a couple of square centimeters for one flower to grow on it. And I thought that's a really pretty flower. And that peak was about a meter of just abyss in between that and the cliff edge. So I decided to just start sprinting to make that jump, try and land on that tiny patch of grass, pluck that flower and give it to my mum. And then I was intercepted at the last moment. And I seem to have memories of that, but I don't know whether that is, you know, and that was very young, but I think that is probably just artificial. Whereas the, at least, however banal it is, the Pikachu slippers are authentic.
Yeah, that's cool. Cool. That was a great answer. I really enjoyed that. Thank you so much for joining us on this show.
Thank you.
It was lovely.
And loved being here. And loved talking to you, as always.
Great. And on that note, have a great year.
Thank you. You as
and
well.
Very excited to see what you do with the business and where you go from here and catch up with you more over 2022.
Sounds good. Have a fantastic new year, Sam.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you head on to another episode, what's your biggest aha moment from today's discussion? You can share with us your insights and join us on Reason FM. Reason FM is a social podcasting app and the best way to discover new podcasts, connect with hosts and other listeners. Also, don't forget to tune into the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with me and my co-host Nico, and we expose you to a different perspective and dive into the world's most thought-provoking and inspiring books. That's all for this episode, and with that, keep learning and keep growing.